This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The stock market began a fall from record highs last week with a serious tumble on Friday that sent jitters through investors just beginning to feel comfortable again after experiencing terrible losses during the Great Recession. Yesterday, the market reacted negatively to a disappointing housing report. It seems new home sales slid 7% in December. Investors chose to react to that as opposed to the fact that lean inventories and steady price gains suggest strength in that sector, and while other data indicated the private sector maintained its growth pace in January. Was the market drop a serious setback or merely a healthy correction? And if you're approaching or in retirement, does it really matter? After all, we all want to see our retirement portfolios and our college saving funds grow in value, not lose money. So, as investors recover from those horrible losses of 2008, as we get up the courage to re-enter the market, how do we protect ourselves and our money from future losses? How do we insulate ourselves and our reptilian brains from the ups and downs of a market that sometimes appears illogical? And given that we're at the beginning of a new year, how do you plan for the year ahead? What tax changes do you need to consider in 2014? For answers to those questions and more, we've invited back two financial advisors who have been with us several times in the past. Larry Carroll is president and CEO of Carroll Financial Associates, one of the Charlotte region's oldest and largest financial planning and investment management firms. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
Bill Staton has been managing director and chief investment officer for Staton Financial Advisors since it began in 2000 and has been managing money since 1971. Good morning to you. Welcome.
Thank you,
back
Mike.
To hear the national news tell it last week was dire on Wall Street, and those of us with our retirements hanging in the balance, we should all be concerned. I'm going to wager, please, no wagering, I'm going to bet that this does not concern you.
Not in the least. I mean, Bill and I were talking walking in that there's all this concern about the markets at this point in time in the last week or so. We're 3% below the all-time high. I mean, that's nothing. People have become more and more short-term focused, short-term oriented. You're right in your lead-in that a lot of this comes from the two bad markets over the last 12 years, and every time you get a week or two that's down, there's this immediate concern that we're going down 50% again.
Right. And there's no justification for that, Mike. I've looked back at all of the periods when we had severe bear markets since World War II. They all occurred during a recession. Mm-hmm. And we are not in a recession now and nowhere close. Now, when we have bear markets or down market corrections outside a recession, they typically are less than 20% peak to trough, and they typically last about 9 months. So that's not really a big deal. It's turbulence.
But what happened in 2008 was so precipitous, and it was also, I think, to most people, completely out of the blue, completely unexpected. And when it started, it just began a steady fall. It looked like it was going to go to zero. And I think people have memories of that, and it's a visceral reaction, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like it leaves a scar on your psyche. Mm-hmm. That's there long term. But, you know, people have to understand and find a way to get comfortable with the idea that market fluctuates over time. It's a very natural part of the investing process. The average drawdown from a top to a bottom in any given year is 14.7%. So if this market went down 14.7 from its beginning number this year, it'd just be a normal reaction. But the volatility of the markets is the price that you pay to get the long-term higher returns that markets provide.
Well, you say that people have to work to curb their emotional reaction to markets and stick to the plan. Yes, but for how long?
Well, it's very, very difficult when you're bombarded every single day with negative stories about this and that and the other. And
does the media get it wrong?
The media doesn't understand, including a lot of the business media. They don't study companies like I do and like Larry does and read what Caterpillar is doing in reality versus what the media might be saying about them, or IBM or McDonald's.
But Bill, a lot of the market is driven by institutional investors who are supposed to be pros at this. They are reacting emotionally to things and causing the market to gyrate up and down, and they're supposed to know what they're doing.
Well, see, you use the word reacting as opposed to responding with ability, responsibility. You take advantage of these downturns. Stocks are the only things that exist that I know of, Larry and I know of, that people don't like to buy on sale. They'd rather pay $220 a share for IBM than buy it today at $180, $40 less.
And I understand that. We've talked about this before many times. But the problem is those people who are in the market already have bought their inventory, and suddenly their inventory is worthless, and they start to get upset about this and worry. And you talk about reacting. What about being proactive? How do you protect yourself on the downside by being proactive?
There's way too much focus on this idea of protecting on the downside.
I agree.
Over longer periods of time, markets, if you look at any chart or graph of the market, it goes up and to the left and to the right,
One hopes,
up and to the right. All the stuff in between is kind of noise. And where you lose money is you buy overvalued assets and you sell them when they go down to reasonable value. And you lock in a permanent loss. If you buy reasonably valued or cheap assets, you don't lose capital long term. Now, I know that's a little bit more difficult to say, but it goes back to what Bill was just referring to. Everybody loved Apple at 700. Nobody wanted it at 400. Nobody wants it today at 500.
Oh, that's right.
But they were in love with it at 700. It doesn't make a lot of sense, and it destroys capital when you buy high and sell low.
One of your colleagues, Larry, Carl Brooks, I believe, works with you, says that watching CNBC and tracking market values every day do not promote knowledge or understanding. Rather, it exacerbates those little voices in your head, the voices of fear and greed, and increases the feeling to act on the loudest voice.
So that's again, well said.
So how should you act? What should you do?
Well, first of all, you don't have to listen to or watch any of that stuff. I don't, and I haven't for years. People say, what's your favorite financial show? I don't have one because I think it is noise, and I think it's a distraction.
You watch the guy that screams and shouts and draws on the blind?
No. Well, only when Larry's doing it. Larry lives right around the corner. But we just, as Larry says, we continue to look at value and establishing a reasonable price for a world-class company like IBM, McDonald's, Procter & Gamble is not all that difficult, Mike. It doesn't mean that when we buy it, it might not go down in the short run, but in the longer run, we can be pretty certain of two things. Number one, they'll be in business. Number two, they'll continue to grow. And actually, number three, they'll raise the dividend. You know, we have 17 companies. 17 companies based in America have paid a higher cash dividend for at least 50 consecutive years. That's almost every year since World War II ended. I mean, that's an amazing statistic.
Since Bill commented on one of your colleagues' quotes, I'll let you comment on one of Bill's quotes, though, Larry. You say that Bill says that because individuals are still very scared of stocks overall, that shows that there is no bubble in the market. So the value of the market is real. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yes, it is.
You agree with that?
Well, I do agree with that. Bill kind of alluded to this earlier, but I think it's important. Bull markets don't end just because they get some age on them, because they've lasted 5 or 6 years. They end because you get recession, and there's absolutely no sign of that at this point.
Right.
Or they end because you get real excesses, speculation, stocks are at 30 times earnings like they were in 1999. That would bring about the end. Right now, reasonably valued, and the economy is okay, growing very slowly. This isn't where a good market ends. That doesn't mean it has to go up a lot, but I think the risks are pretty low at this point unless we get more information that would change that opinion.
We talked the last time you were here, which was a couple of months ago, about what people are skittish about the stock market because of what happened in the recession, and they're still out of the market, according to you, Bill, because you're saying
plenty of people
that the value of the market is not due to people just getting in the market willingly and bidding prices up. It's real value. Who should be in the stock market?
Well, I think just about everybody. Our oldest client is 93 years old, going on 94, and she's heavily invested in U.S.-based, what we call world-class dividend growers, and they've continued to do well. You've got interest rates not at record lows, but closer to lows, all-time lows than all-time highs. And people have forgotten, Mike, that interest rates have been coming down from 81 into 2014. But from 1941 to 1981, they went up almost straight for 40 years. So if you had $100,000 worth of bonds in 1941, in purchasing power terms, 40 years later, they were worth $30,000. You lost 70% of your purchasing power. And you've got to have assets that grow, because the big danger for most Americans, we both believe, is you outlive your money. You outlive your money. What are you going to do to protect your capital?
That is the real risk for most people. And, you know, we both have the clients in the 90s that are 100% stocks. The tragedy in the market, in my mind, is the people who are 60 or 65 and have virtually nothing in the market. How are you going to fund a 30-year retirement with 2% interest rates?
Yeah, you can't be done.
I can't make the numbers work.
Mm-hmm. Those who got out of the market and never got back in did not take advantage of the extreme gains that have been taking place. And we've talked about really not being able to time the market. That's a foolish strategy, and you're going to lose. Is it too late to get in? When is it too late to get in? Is it if you're not in now, or you've been scared to get back in, is it too late?
Well, you have to ask yourself the question, Mike, you know, what am I trying to do? I guess if you've got millions and millions of dollars, you don't mind earning next to nothing in a bank account. But that's not true for most Americans. Most of us are fighting rising inflation every year. Taxes just went up for 2013 and 14. And you've got to have a guard against those two bugaboos, inflation and taxes, not to mention as you get older, higher medical expenses and so forth and so on. So you've got to own quality companies like IBM, for example. The dividend has grown at a double-digit rate for as many years as I care to count. So it's been true with McDonald's. Double-digit rates. People aren't getting those kinds of salary increases, but they can get it off owning quality companies.
I mean, last year in the market was pretty good, 2013. But your son, Chris, who's also a financial advisor, Larry, says not to expect another big year from equity markets again this year. I imagine that you would agree with that. So what should we expect from 2014? And if you're not in the market and you're thinking about getting in, gee, if it's not going to be so good, why should I do that?
Yeah, let's go back to your question. I'll bring it forward about the person that got out and when do you get back in. It's very, very difficult psychologically, because you have to admit, I made a huge mistake when I got out. And people aren't inclined to say that. They rationalize, and it becomes more and more difficult to get back in. We have an investment meeting in December where we have 20 different managers and mutual fund groups, and I'll come in and present to our people. And when we did that this December, there was tremendous consensus that in 2014 the market would be up 8 to 12%. And if you go on the internet and look at different people, you're going to consistently see the market's going to be up 8 to 12%.
But hold on, because we have to take a break.
Okay.
We will come back to that. I'll let you recap it yet again. Larry Carroll is with us from Carroll Financial Associates. Bill Staton is also here, chairman of Staton Financial Advisors. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the International Collectibles and Antiques Show at Metrolina Expo, where Charlottean pickers come to shop Thursday through February 2nd at 7100 Statesville Road. Details at icashows.com. Well, the number of charter schools around North Carolina is increasing. A new reading law may find third graders going to summer reading camps this year. Common Core standards and digital learning are transforming what kids learn and how they learn it. And there's overcrowding in Union County. In short, there's a lot going on in the schools. And we'll talk to two reporters who cover it every day about all the things that are changing that involve schools and parents and children tomorrow morning. at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, falling unemployment, steady job growth, jittery markets, and transition at the Federal Reserve, what it all means for the U.S. economy.
Join that discussion on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Bill Staten's with us from Staten Financial Advisors. Larry Carroll from Carroll Financial Associates. We're talking about the market and your investments for retirement, for your college savings funds. We're going to get to taxes this year, among other things. And you were in the middle of going through a long explanation of who should be in the market, and is this going to be a good year to get in the market? And you were taking us back to those people who got out of the market and never got back in.
Right. So you're still on the sidelines. And the point I was going to was there's tremendous consensus that 2014 will be up between 8 and 12%. Well, markets don't tend to do what everybody in the world thinks they're going to do. So we think it will either be less than that or more than that. If we have to bet, we think it'll be less than that. But you still get a number that may be 4 to 7%. It's better than you get anywhere else at this particular point in time.
Better than treasuries, better than a passbook savings account, better than a CD.
You take the approach that Bill's alluded to about locking in good dividends. You're going to get dividends better than any of the other things yield. If you got good news out of the economy, you could get something above that 12% if we got news that we didn't know about at this point in time, a positive surprise. I think what the person that's out has to do is sit down with their advisor and put together a plan of how we're going to get this money back in. It could be that for the equity part of the portfolio, you dollar cost average it in monthly to get some money in there. It could be that you take a relative.
Meaning that you don't put the whole lump in at once.
You don't put the whole lump in at one time. It could be that you put 20 to 30% in to some high quality things that you can get comfortable with, and then lay out a plan to add to that over time to get to whatever your equity exposure is. I think because of the experience, you might do more conservative things than you might otherwise have done if you'd been in for a long period of time.
And that would be what?
The big blue chip dividend payers that you know aren't going out of business. Bill referred to IBM. That's a great example. Apple would be another example. Mm-hmm. Some things that you know and understand what they do. You know they're going to be in business. They've got big cash. They pay good dividends.
If we keep hearing stories of people approaching retirement age with little to nothing in their reserves, and that means and people are
that's true.
It's tough.
Absolutely true.
People can't get jobs in this market. People have not put a lot of money away. They have daily expenses. They have mortgages to pay and kids to put through school and clothes to buy and food to buy. So they're putting little teeny bits away over time, most people. So are you telling those kinds of investors, not these big high-dollar people, but those people, are you telling them to put their money in individual stocks, or are you telling them to put them in mutual funds or some other kind of
Mike, investment? We have a program we've given away maybe 100,000 copies called the $50 a Month Millionaire. You can download it off our website, statenfinancial.com. And it shows people how to take small amounts of money and invest directly into companies like McDonald's and IBM. Simple example, if you've got a child, a grandchild under 18, you can invest $100 directly into McDonald's and then add to it with as little as $50 at a time.
And by investing directly, you're not paying fees.
Well, in general, fees are smaller than the broker would charge. And a broker's not going to – you can't call a broker and say, I've got $100. I want to buy 1.03 shares of McDonald's. You can't do that. All four of our adult children have been on direct investing since they were young. Our two grandsons are on it. You can download this program. It's online. You don't have to deal with us. It's no charge. You can do it all. And it works.
And
call the $50 a month millionaire.
If you're not financial and don't want to do that, then funds are probably the answer for the person you describe. rather than the buying the individual.
And should stock. Most individual people who are not saving for their college investments or not saving for the next car that they have to buy, they're actually saving this for retirement. They should be putting this in a 401k or an IRA or something.
Yeah, that should be the first thing that they do, particularly if there's any matching. You need to maximize the 401k before you look at other things.
And, Mike, every year a person waits, it takes that much more money set aside in order to get wherever it is they're trying to go. So, for example, in direct investing, I calculated this because we teach at Charlotte Country Day, Mary and I do every semester. At age 16 to 17, it takes about $20 a month to get to the same place at age 65 that if you were in your 40s, it takes about $4,400 a month. See the difference? Most people in their 40s don't have $4,400 a month to set aside.
To start soon.
But the $20, everybody's wasting $20, $30 bucks. I mean, it's easy.
Compound interest, eighth wonder of the world.
Forbes magazine suggests a 401k goal of at least matching your employer's full matching contribution and then increasing your own contribution by 1% every 6 months so that you work up to 10% of your income over time, going in every month to your 401k. Do you agree with that? And can most people put 10% of their income into anything?
Well, first of all, Mike, you're doing it on a gradual basis. Second of all, it's automatically deducted, so you don't really miss it from your paycheck. It's just like when you have a Piedmont Natural Gas bill drafted out of your bank account. It's painless. If you're writing a check because you used a lot of gas because it's cold, there's a lot of pain associated with it. So it's a painless way to build your financial future.
Which seemed to me to be wiser to write the check for expenses and experience the pain. So you
We do. We have a lot of pain every month.
If your employer does not offer a 401k, or even if they do, should you also be funding an IRA?
Yeah, I would.
If you can. I mean, you kind of alluded to this. There has to be some level of reality and balance between your income and your outflows. The plan that Forbes alludes to would get you to the ability to retire at 65 if you started that early in your career. You know, you're right that most people in their early 60s at this point really aren't prepared for retirement. It has really significant implications in that those people are going to work longer because they can't afford to retire. That's going to back up the people under them that would historically get promoted into their position when they retire. This people working 5-10 years longer has some implications as to how things work. The other thing that's happening that I think is important is a lot of these people would historically get bailed out when they inherited, and their parents are living so long now they spend most of the money. The inheritance is not as big and may not be enough to bail them out of that situation. There's a lot going on out there.
Put your headphones on. We'll take a couple of calls, and one I think is an interesting one. We'll start with the really interesting one first. John and Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. I enjoy your two gents when they come on, but my question for them is, how did they advise their investors in the fall of 2008? Did they pull out at some point because they knew that it would bottom out, or did they say ride it all the way down?
Well, we had, in the case of our clients, we didn't have that bad a year in 2008, although we were fully invested. The market was down almost 40%. We were down a little bit more than 20%, which I didn't think was too shabby. But we had to fight like crazy, and I'm sure Larry did too, to keep people in, because the lower things went, the more desperate they felt like they had become, and they just couldn't stand it.
And did you ever have second thoughts about that?
Yeah.
I mean, you're telling people are really and legitimately nervous back then.
Oh, my God, scared. I mean, scared as I've ever seen them. And Larry and I have been around a long time. Look how gray his hair is.
That's right. It's the hardest I've ever worked, fourth quarter of 2008,
really
first quarter of 2009. I'm doing 11-12 meetings a day, phone calls.
Conference calls we did.
Trying to keep people in, trying to provide perspective.
I mean, the thing went down precipitously. Were you not worried that you were making the wrong decision, giving the wrong advice?
No, not based on history.
There has never been a time in history when that was the right move.
Not even 1929?
Over a longer period of time.
Not even 1929?
No, you recovered from 29.
Some did. Some jumped off the tops of buildings.
I think that was a rumor. Those were actually dolls that were tossed off.
Well, you know, the part of the lesson of that of 29, I think, was there was leverage or margin involved.
10% down.
Which we will not do, and I'm sure Bill would not do with the client. But if you, you know, when you, you've heard me say this 100 times, Mike, but when you try to time the market and get out, you have to make two good decisions. When to get out and when to get back in. If you didn't get out, you have more than recovered from 2008, 2009 at this point.
Well, let's.
If you didn't get both sides of it right back then, you hadn't recovered.
But let's, for those people who are skittish about getting in or getting back in now, and despite the gains that the market has experienced because of what happened in 2008, talk about the person who was 65 or 64 or worse, 68, 69, and living off that nest egg when it lost 40% of its value, and then it took 5 years for it to recover.
But, Mike, we had clients just like during the 29 crash. We had clients that their dividend income was growing, and it was pretty much sufficient to carry them through, so they weren't so much worried about the price decline. Furthermore, you've got to realize – if something goes down 40% in 1 year, you're not taking out all your money in that year. Maybe you're taking it out over the next 20 or 25 years. So it's not like you're all of your, you know, you take all the money out of the 40% down. That just isn't the case.
I think your point makes the point of why you might not want to be 100% stocks when you're 65. So that when you get the downturns, you can take your needed income from the other assets and give the stock or equity part of the portfolio time to recover rather than having to sell into that down market. So there's an asset allocation aspect of that that goes with it, Mike.
I'm not sure that you agree with what Larry just said, and I'll tell you why, because many people do believe that as you approach retirement, once you're in retirement, you need to back off your exposure to equities and move to bonds or some other safer instruments that pay either interest versus dividends, et cetera. You say that it's just the opposite, that they should be in stocks.
Yeah, I mean, there's very credible evidence. I can show you, if we had time, I can show you four studies that have come out in the past 6 or 9 months about it, that a lot of people tend to be overly conservative, and they have too much cash and too much fixed income, and they basically taken the growth out of their investments, and so they get into a situation. We all have surprises, black swans. You know, your house burns down or whatever, you have serious medical expenses that are not covered by insurance, and then what are you going to do? So you've always got to think about protecting yourself in the growth, and you've just got to have growth.
My typical client is either retired or at the point of retirement. Their accounts are normally 50 to 60% equities. Now that's a little bit different than Bill might do. Bill and I both in our personal accounts would be comfortable being 100% equities. We don't force that on clients. We would do an asset allocation approach. We would make sure they had some things that would provide their income in a situation where the market was down, so they could wait for recovery. It's an individual decision as to how much exposure and what level of risk. I think what we're both saying, though, is the level of risk should not be zero because the numbers don't work over time.
Let me go back to the phone. Tim in Charlotte, you're on WFAE. Tim, welcome.
Welcome to you guys. I'm in my late 50s and have ridden the stock market, you know, over the past 8 to 10 years. And I guess I'm saying the same thing that Bill was saying, is I haven't lost a dime in the stock market. The value of my portfolio has gone down considerably, but I haven't lost a dime in the market because I haven't sold anything.
Well, you're whether you sold or not, you're still down if you're below where your previous high was. But having said that, at least it sounds like that you weren't scared out of your positions. We've always told people three things, and this applies to any type of investment you make, Chinese ceramics, gold coins, or whatever. Number one, it always has to be highest quality. Number two, you try to assess and pay a reasonable price. Doesn't have to be bargain, reasonable. And number three, you've got to be patient and give it time to work out. That applies to real estate or anything you're looking at. So a lot of people just become impatient. They think, well, if my money manager, Larry or Bill, buys something for me today, it should be going up tomorrow. Well, if they've got extra cash that's going to be coming in, and we both have clients that bring in cash from time to time, if it goes down, they'd actually be better off because they buy more shares for the same dollar amount. Mm-hmm. And to us, that makes perfect common sense. But I guess to a lot of human brains, it sounds totally irrational.
Prices change a lot more than the facts change.
Right.
If the facts are still in place, don't worry about the daily fluctuation in prices. You'll still come out the back end, and quality is one of the facts.
Quality has got to be
both
there.
Of you are throwing around this quality word. What does that mean? How do you determine quality?
When we teach a class, and I also teach twice a month at the county jail, I always ask people, here's two investment rules. Number one, you pick five highest quality companies. You pick them. Number two, you have to hold for 20 years before you sell. Can't sell for another 20 years. But all along the way, you can buy more of any of the five you chose. People instinctively go to Procter & Gamble, Colgate, IBM, McDonald's, because everybody instinctively knows quality. They're not talking about Twitter, Bitcoin, even Apple or Google. They're talking about things that have been around. AT&T's been around since 1856. And Bob Hope used to joke, he bought it when it was called American Smoke Signals. I mean, that's staying power.
Yeah. But don't companies, even like AT&T might be a good example or a bad example. Let's just use it for this. They brought the telephone to everybody in the country, and now they're bringing internet and they're bringing television into your living rooms, and they've expanded and grown. But are there not life cycles to companies? Don't some companies simply run out of steam over time, even though they were high quality for years and everybody from your great grandmother on knew who they were?
Happened to Polaroid.
Okay,
right.
Polaroid's a great example.
But let's come back to what I just said mm-hmm. previously. The facts changed in those situations. The business changed. It's not buy and forget. Buy and hold is not buy and forget. You
Good
still
point.
Have to pay attention to what's going on in the base business. And businesses do change. Lucent's a great example of a situation that changed, and Polaroid.
And Kodak.
So you got to pay attention, but people pay too much attention to daily fluctuations.
So if you bought a Kodak in 10 years before it went under, and you're saying hold on to it, you shouldn't hold on to it. You should get out of it, right?
You could, here, Mike, you could always look at the dividend. If the dividend is not growing consistently every single year, that's our opinion, and it was not in Kodak and it was not in Polaroid, then
that's a smoke signal.
You get out of it, right. Yeah.
That's Bill Staton, Chairman of Staton Financial Advisors. Larry Carroll's here, President and CEO of Carroll Financial Associates, the company that bears his name. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings, LLP, a full-service law firm serving the construction industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation, partnering with clients through all phases of a project. Details at babc.com. And Jerusalem, now showing in IMAX at Discovery Place. Journey to one of the world's oldest and most enigmatic cities, exploring history and discovering our common heritage. Ticket information at discoveryplace.org. Falling unemployment, steady job creation, jittery markets, and transition at the Federal Reserve. What it all means for the U.S. economy, Diane Rehm stealing our show next hour, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. You may have some questions or comments yourself. Join us, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is the place to start, and we are coming right back.
Tonight, an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union Address. I'm Robert Siegel. Join me for in-depth analysis and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republicans' response to the president's speech, an NPR News special, President Obama's State of the Union Address.
And you can hear NPR's State of the Union coverage tonight, beginning at 9, here on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about money with Larry Carroll and Bill Staton. We're going to get to taxes in a few seconds, but Sean emails, give us an example of a portfolio for a 50-year-old couple with $500,000 in savings, no college funding needs, no mortgage. What percentage should we invest in stocks, bonds, cash?
Well, from our perspective, at their age and looking at that situation, I would be 100% equities because they've got plenty of time to make it work out.
And in terms of equities, would you be aggressive, moderately aggressive, conservative? Where would you be?
I don't use the terms. I use the term conservative. And the first benchmark we look at, Mike, is always, always that cash dividend has to be growing year after year after year. Diebold that makes the ATM machines, mm-hmm. 63, 64 years in a row of higher dividends. Now, that's staying power. So you want staying power in your portfolio. And you can just ask yourself the question, if I own shares of this particular company, what is the likelihood it's going to go under? I mean, if IBM and McDonald's and Walmart go under, we got a lot bigger problems than IBM, Walmart, and McDonald's going under. And they're just simply not. Valspar, the paint company, has been in business since Jefferson was in the White House, and it's still in business.
Okay.
Well, I think in the scenario outlined that I'd be pretty close to 100% equities also, particularly if their income provided for all of their needs. They had discretionary cash flow over and above covering their expenses. The situation on the job side may affect how much I had in cash reserves, not in the market, mm-hmm. the stability of that income stream. But that's a prime situation where they should be equity investors.
You know, the capital gains tax went up this year. Should people be concerned about that in terms of being reluctant to put everything in stock as opposed to holding some back in cash for emergencies because they don't want to sell and pay the capital gains tax?
Well, whatever you make on cash or bonds are basically taxable to you at ordinary rates. So capital gains rates are still a good thing. And if your income, if your taxable income is under $72,000 a year, long-term capital gains are taxed at zero. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a pretty good deal.
It sure is.
Sean has just emailed back. So what do you do to protect your capital?
Well, are you talking about protecting it in terms of keeping it from going down in a given year? I don't know any way to do that. But if you're talking in terms of protecting your capital, again, we go back to the two killers. Number one, taxes, and number two, inflation. During our lifetimes, inflation has gone up relentlessly year after year. When the Federal Reserve was formed just a little bit more than 100 years ago, what was worth a dollar then is worth 4 cents today. That's you've lost 96% of your purchasing power. And since 1980, the cost of living, even as defined by our government, which Larry and I believe the numbers are low, has more than tripled. What are you going to do? You can't do it in bonds and cash. You've got to have assets like quality real estate that appreciate in value.
Sean is 50 years old. The investment time frame for he and his wife is 40 years. It's not what the market does next year or next month. It's where are the best returns going to be over this 40-year period where I need to invest my money and provide for my wife and family.
Richard emails, the stream of scandals about hedge funds front-running the market and trading on inside information must mean that retail investors and even traditional institutional investors are, by definition, penalized. How great a penalty are we paying these hedge fund thieves? Surely it's 100 basis points a year. Do they think it's much greater? That meaning you, do you think it's much greater? Is the market too rigged to trust but too big to ignore?
I think that is verbiage that comes from someone looking for an excuse not to invest. I just don't believe it. you know, yeah, we had somebody at a hedge fund prosecuted for insider trading this year, last year, 2013. But the idea that it's pervasive and that markets are rigged, I just don't believe.
I don't believe that's factually valid. And there have always been sharks and charlatans in the markets going back in this country, any country you care to name. But back in the roaring 20s, Mike, there were these investment pools that really did rig the market. You know, they'd buy a lot of – they'd call everybody. Everybody knew one another, and they'd buy the shares, and then they'd start to – and they'd drive them way up. Then they'd drag the public into it, you know, mm-hmm. and they say, it's going way up, we're going to buy. And then they started liquidating and got out, and the public was left holding the bag in some instances.
I'm going to come back to Bill's one of Bill's examples. I think
hold on just a second. Are there laws to prevent that from happening again?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Larry.
You know, I think your return on McDonald's is going to be determined by how many Big Macs they sell, not by anybody rigging the markets. I don't think there's – now, some of that could take place in the penny stock part of the market. But as we've stated several times, that's not the quality part of the market. If you're buying quality, I don't think you have those issues.
And the gentleman that you're referring to may be looking at this new movie, The Wolf of Wall Street, and things like that. That certainly they do go on. But again, when you're talking about large, high-quality companies, I just don't see that we're really affected.
And The Wolf of Wall Street was 20 years ago and was in the penny stock part of the market.
It certainly was, yeah.
There have been some tax changes in North Carolina that went into effect on January the 1st. Will any of these changes that you know about here or the changes federally come into play at tax time for 2013, or are they all going forward to 2014?
Well, I think two things are going on out there. I think when people go to their accountant to file their 2013 tax return, I think high-income people are going to be surprised by their tax bill because we had rates go up in 2013, and if your income is over $250,000, they added the 3.8% surtax on top. So I think these people are going to go in to file their tax return and get a huge surprise as to how much they owe at that point. I think that advisors are going to have to pay more and more attention to the tax side of things.
Financial advisors.
Mm-hmm. I'm happy to have a CPA certificate that I don't maintain anymore, but I mean it's a pretty good background to deal with some of these things. The other thing that we're seeing as a big issue, and I'm going to use a fairly specific situation or example. A lady retires at 62, single lady. She has $1 million in an IRA. She has about $400,000 outside the IRA. She finds out that if she can keep her taxable income under $45,000 a year, it makes a difference on her health care cost of almost $500 a month. So over $5,000 a year for keeping your income under $45,000. Now, because she's 62 and doesn't have to take distributions from her IRA until she's 70 and a half, we can keep her under that number. If it wasn't in an IRA, you might not be able to do that. It's funny that she's not the person they intended that change for, but it's built into the system, and, you know, that's the way we'll play the game. We'll work to decrease her health care costs by keeping her taxable income down. And most people don't know about that either. I think there's a lot going on tax-wise, and it's going to become a bigger and bigger issue with the investing process.
But you also got to keep history in mind too, Mike, and Larry's right. You can focus on it with individuals, but you will find almost zero correlation over the decades between how high taxes were and how high markets were. Under Kennedy, the marginal tax rate was 90%, the highest it's ever been in history, and we had what are now labeled the Soaring 60s. We had the Roaring 20s, and we had the Soaring 60s. So clearly, if taxes had been that big a bugaboo for the average investor, we couldn't have had that kind of a market.
Taxes don't kill markets.
They certainly do not.
You need to pay attention to them, but they don't kill markets.
Is that why you say you should not let taxes get ahead of prudent investing?
Absolutely. No? Absolutely.
Lots of people never discuss their finances with anybody in their families, other than perhaps their financial advisor, if they have one. And you stress, Larry, having those discussions with your family, because treating those conversations as taboo makes it harder on the family. When you say family, who are you talking about? The spouse? Are you talking about the kids? Who are you talking about?
It could be any of those. I'm really targeting that comment toward people who are getting older. You know, when you're 80, 85, 90 years old, other people need to know about your finances. They need to know where your will is and how to process that. They need to know your PIN numbers to access information when something happens to you. We think there needs to be more communication. I fully understand that everybody's not comfortable with that. But if you're not comfortable with communicating, make sure it's written down somewhere and they know where to find, quote-unquote, the book, if something happens to you, to get all that information.
It used to be easier because it was actually a book.
That's right. That's exactly right.
My father kept it in the strong box under the chair in the master bedroom.
Yeah. And now so much of it's online.
On computer, yeah.
If they can't access it,
that's right.
They don't know what to do.
Yeah. Like 2 years ago, Mary and I started the process of writing down all these little details. And unfortunately, I don't think there's a form. But anyway, we spent hours.
I got a form.
All right, Larry's got one. We didn't know Larry had one, so we did it from scratch.
And you better get on board.
We sent it to our state planning attorney. He said he'd never seen anything so comprehensive. So he had a copy of it. All of our children have copies of it. And they said it really does make the final moments real, but at least they know where all the papers are and, you know, how things are. This is outside the will and estate plan. This is just, you know, on paper.
Because I've dealt with several situations, I also think that I don't like the next generation being totally surprised by what's happening to your money. You know, you write people out of the will, you discriminate in terms of, I understand doing that, but you tend to get some pretty bad situations if they find out about it after your death.
Bad blood.
You get bad blood in the family real quickly.
So you should tell your wayward black sheep son, and we're writing you up?
I would, and I'd tell him exactly why.
Maybe he can change before it's too late.
I can tell you that the assuming you have two children and one's that black sheep son, if you do it without anybody knowing about it, those two children are never going to have a relationship going forward, mm-hmm. based on what I've seen.
Okay. You know, a lot of people depended, particularly older people, on bonds. Bonds have not done well in the last several years. Why aren't they performing well?
Well, interest rates, I mean, this is our 223rd year, Mike, of the history of a 10-year Treasury bond. And in the first half of last year, 2013, the yield on that 10-year Treasury bond dropped to an all-time low. Think about that, the lowest rate in 222 years. I mean, if you're on a mattress and you roll off, you don't have far to hit the floor, and that's about where we've been with interest rates. So it's illogical to think they're going to continue to go down so you can make more money in bonds. Maybe they stay flat for a long while, or maybe they start to trend upward.
So in lieu of bonds, if people had bonds because they wanted a certain return and a safe certain return, where do you go?
Well, look at AT&T. The current dividend yield is 5.2%. Mm-hmm. It's an investment-grade company. They've raised the dividend every single year for 30 consecutive years. They buy in shares every single year, and it yields more than any of their investment-grade bonds.
Yeah, let me give you a little bit different answer. I think when you look at bonds in a portfolio, you have to think in terms of what role do they play in the portfolio. If their role is safety and stability, then you may still own some bonds, money market funds, CDs to provide the safety and stability. If their role is to provide income, you're buying a totally different type of bonds and you're taking some risk in that part of the portfolio. So are they there for income or are they there for safety and stability? And in this market, they don't fill both roles very easily.
If you're just starting out, if you're 20 years old, 22 years old, got your first job, not making a lot of money yet, when should you start saving for retirement, and where do you find the money on that small salary to
do it? Just started yesterday.
Yeah, you look at the money you waste. Mike, in all of the years I have asked this question to audiences all over the country, here locally and whatever, schools, I've had one hand go up from a 14-year-old who said, I don't waste at least $50 a month. That's one hand out of thousands of people. Now, if everybody's wasting at least $50 a month, that's $600 a year minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And $600 a year minimum in your 20s invested wisely can go a heck of a long way.
And you suggest actually sitting down and making a budget, something that most people probably don't do. And it's easier today than ever before.
It's easier today than ever before because you have so many online tools that will help you with that process and will help you track spending. You know, if Bill went in and input all of his expenditures into one of those programs, he'd be asking himself the question, why does he always drink that $4 coffee from Starbucks rather than $1.50?
I gave it up years ago, Larry, because I couldn't afford it.
That's right.
What's the difference?
He did the numbers.
In 30 seconds, what's the difference between the portfolio investment approach of someone who wants to get rich as opposed to somebody who wants to have a comfortable retirement?
I'm going to tell you that if a person walks in my office and says they want to get rich, I may not take that account.
We hope you inherit it.
That's right. It's just so much different.
Luck.
So much different than what Bill and I do in terms of trying to grind it out on a day-to-day basis and reach retirement.
It's possible.
Larry Carroll, who now refuses to take my money, is president and CEO of Carroll Financial Associates. Bill Staton, chairman of Staton Financial Advisors. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Mike.